Hi listeners, it's Lucy. Please don't scroll ahead. This is a very quick message, I promise, to ask a very easy favour. At the end of each episode, as the credits roll, you'll hear a request from us to rate and review the show. Now, for those of you that are awesome podcast listeners rather than podcast makers, you might actually have no idea what a huge difference those things make. A significant factor in the visibility of a podcast on almost all listening platforms is down to the number and quality of ratings and subscriptions. So, if you are one of our dedicated listeners, hi, I know some of you are as far away as Australia, so thanks. If you're currently not driving your car or changing a baby's nappy, can you please just look down at your phone right now as I'm talking and hit subscribe and 5-star rating? Both of them are on the homepage of the show and they are both only a one-click job. But oh my God, what a lot of joy and gratitude I would feel at those one clicks. It makes such a difference to the show's potential to keep going. Now, enjoy the episode and thanks for listening.
You're about to hear a brief conversation with an incredible artist. Part autobiographical journey, part literary analysis, and part late-night chat in the theatre bar. This is Hear Me Out.
And I'm your host, Lucy Eaton. Please welcome to the stage, Neil Gaiman.
So we've just been chatting as you arrived, and I had to keep metaphorically slapping you on the back of the hand and saying no.
Yes, not allowed to talk about what we have to talk
exactly, about. Exactly, not until the cameras are rolling. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I think of a podcast like this as kind of being the equivalent of when sometimes as a writer, people will say to you things like, you know, you can write a short story any length you like about anything you want, and we'll give you all the money. And you go, great, I have no ideas. And then somebody will come up to you and say, we're doing an anthology. It's about Shakespeare's cats. So it has to be have Shakespeare in it and a cat, and we're only paying a fiver a story.
And you're like, I've got a million ideas.
You're like, okay, yeah, I'm done. So this one for me, you coming and saying, would you like to do this? And I was like, well, I'm not an actor, and I'm not somebody who does audition pieces, and I'm somebody who spends most of my life feeling very sorry for actors who have to.
Yes, yes.
But actually, I think I'd love to do this,
and you know
I think
what?
I love, and I think I knew exactly where I wanted to go.
Well, and because you're
me.
A writer, and you're a brilliant writer, that's why I was so keen to have you on the show. Well, because you're a brilliant human being, but you're such a great writer, and your writing is so varied. I wanted more and more to get people who weren't actors on the show, as in I want actors primarily, of course, but I wanted more and more to go really. I see the podcast as a celebration of writing. Yeah. It just may be most often from the actor's point of view, but I wanted a writer. And of course, also, we'll get onto this later, but I would be fascinated to know more about how you've found seeing your stories developed for theatre, for screen, for animation, you know, all of that sort of stuff. So, but we can get onto that. We can get onto that later. So,
absolutely.
First of all, what is the speech that you picked? You came to it quite quickly.
I don't think there were any other choices, and which was funny. I mean, I think you said, pick a speech. What would your audition speech be? And I did that little, you know, a speed run through all the Shakespeare great speeches, and I loved them all, and they're wonderful. And then immediately settled down on a speech that has fascinated me since I read it. When I would have been 13.
Wow.
I was given, when I was 13 years old, I was given a copy for my birthday of the complete works of Oscar Wilde. And so it had the short stories, it had the plays, it had the novel, it had long, incomprehensible to me at the time, essays, it had poetry and stuff. And one of the plays that it had was Salome. And I read the plays because I'd heard that the importance of being earnest was funny. And it was.
Good.
It
I was about to say, did you find it funny?
I thought it was hilarious.
Yes, great.
I loved the construction. I loved every line about it. I really enjoyed it. I went on and read, you know, Inconstant Husband and Lady Windermere's Fan stuff. And I was like, okay, these are good. They're not the importance of being earnest. The importance of being earnest, he does something very special.
Yes.
And then I hit Salome. And the entirety of Salome, language-wise, was so strange. It was like being plunged into another universe.
Mm.
And on the one hand, it's nominally biblical, but biblical in a way that reminded me a lot of there's an apocryphal story about Oscar Wilde at university doing his Greek exam, and he starts and they give him a portion of the New Testament.
Oh, right.
And he starts reading it and doing an astonishingly brilliant job of translation. And they say, well, that's enough. And he says, no, let me carry on. I have to find out how it ends. The idea of somebody who is looking at matters biblical as literary.
Yeah.
Which does not sound weird to us now. But it's worth bearing in mind that one reason why Salome could not be put on the stage.
Yes.
Was the Lord Chamberlain's office.
So no biblical characters.
Yes, no biblical. You can't put biblical characters on the stage. And it's also something that it's not being written with that Wildean epigraph. It's being painted in blood and dark colors.
Nice, yeah.
Because he's writing it. He writes it in French.
Yes, which I don't think most people know.
It's one of the weirdest things about the play itself. And I think that forces him. Wilde had the kind of brain that could put together quips and epigrams and, you know, the English language was his little Lego set. He could just do whatever he wanted with it and build whatever he wanted out of it. And then you hit Salome, and he's not doing that.
Mm.
There's nothing in Salome that's about what language does to be clever. It's all about what language does to be beautiful, to be moving, to be heartbreaking. And he takes a little known and fairly inexplicable bit of the Bible.
Yeah.
They don't read it a lot.
No, doesn't get read on Christmas Eve.
So you're in a story which feels like a train crash. The characters in it are all headed cheerfully doomward. This story is not going to end happily for anybody in it.
No.
There
will be no wedding and dancing.
No weddings, no dancing. No. And, well, there will be a dance. And it will.
Very good. Oh, of course.
You don't want to.
I don't want the dance.
You don't want the dance. You kind of wish that the dance had not happened.
Yeah.
But essentially, the simplicity of the plot is that John the Baptist, who is called Iokanaan, has come, he's locked up, he's been preaching. They kind of like him to be released, except Herodias does not want him to be released.
And Herodias, for people who don't know, is the wife of Herod.
She's Herod's missus.
Yes.
She wants him dead.
Yes.
She thinks he's trouble.
And this is wife of the Herod that we know for wanting to kill all the babies.
Yep. Baby-killing Herod.
Baby-killing. So this is Mrs. Baby-killing Herod.
This is Baby-killing Herod.
Okay, right, carry on, yeah.
And Herod is very much in love with his wife. Herod also, like everybody else in the story, except Iokanaan, except John the Baptist, is kind of obsessed with Salome, including Salome. Salome is the most obsessed with Salome of everybody in the story. And as a result of which, Salome wants love. Salome wants attention. Mm-hmm. Salome wants everybody to love her. Mm. She wants her sexuality to illuminate the world.
Mm.
And she wants Yochanan. Yeah. And she wants Yochanan because he treats her as if she is the filth and the streets. Mm. He does not see her as Mrs. Beautiful Sexy.
Yeah, which everyone else does seem to, yes.
For everybody else, this is the most beautiful creature.
Mm-mm. And this is, in case we haven't said, we might have done, but this is Herodias's daughter, but not Herod's.
Not Herod's daughter.
So stepdaughter.
So there's a little bit of sort of para-incesty kind of... Herod definitely has a crush on Salome. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a crush on Salome. Passing nameless characters. Mm-hmm. Guards have crushes on Salome.
People, spear carrier number one.
Spear carrier
crush
number
on
one. You know, the moon is beautiful tonight, but Salome, she's hotter. You know, it's that kind of level of absolute obsession.
And then
you get. So everybody in the play is obsessed with Salome. Salome is obsessed with Yochanan.
Yeah.
And Herodias gets her daughter to perform the Dance of the Seven Veils mm-hmm. for Herod.
Mm.
And Herod says, you can have anything.
Mm.
And she says, I want the head of John the Baptist. Then the head is brought to her. And you get this monologue. And I remember reading this monologue when I was 13.
Mm.
And just going, this is awful. This is awful in the sense of this is what grown-ups could be like. There is so much anger and so much tragedy. She's got the thing she wants, not in the way that she wants.
Yes. Which is ultimately a kiss.
Which is ultimately a kiss.
Yeah.
And, it was a lesson that I learned many, many years later when I was writing Good Omen Season 2.
Mm-mm.
And fans would write these letters in going, I hope they're going to kiss. And I'd see, every fourth or fifth letter was, just tell us that, just make us happy.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Crowley and Aziraphale, are they going to kiss in this season? And there was a point where I started to go, I can give you what you want, but you won't want it.
Mm. One of them will have a head on a platter.
But I will give it to you. I will give you what you don't want, thinking that you want. And that's what she wants.
Yeah.
She gets this kiss, and then she gets to make a speech, and the speech is earned. And I think that's probably why I chose it when you said pick a speech. I thought, I don't know of any other play where you really feel deep down in your gut that absolutely everything on the stage is heading towards this speech. And there is nothing really after this speech.
Yeah.
Nothing, there can be nothing after this speech. It is you've built a giant pyramid, and this speech is the capstone.
Yeah, nice. Well, and I think that's one of the things as well, when you say about it being earned, I feel like one criticism of the speech in general in theatre can be, why is someone allowed, in real life, we don't really get to make a speech unless it's a wedding or, and your point is to sit there and talk. So a lot of the time I think in plays we go, well, why did no one interrupt or say something? Whereas in this, the moment and what she's done and what she's doing is so horrifying that maybe also there's an element of, you can understand why she's getting to do a speech because no one dare interrupt.
Well, no one's interrupting her. And more to the point, the person that she's talking to cannot interrupt her.
Yes, very good. Yeah,
because he's on a plate.
Yes, yes. He's missing the bottom four-fifths of his body.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so both of those things are true. And also you get the feeling that the speech tells everybody who was in love with her who she is.
Yes.
And now they can't be in love with her anymore. It's like the... It's that thing of, as long as you can be anything, you can be loved by everyone.
Yeah.
But you've become... Now she's become one thing.
Yeah.
And this one thing is a kind of a monster on the one hand and also kind of pathetic.
Yeah.
She's not...
She's desperate.
Yeah.
Which I guess she was never desperate before. It's reminiscent for me of... did you ever see Posh at the Royal Court?
Mm-mm.
Because that was essentially about... It was done about 10 years ago when it first was written, I think. And it was about a bunch of Oxford students, university students. They were sort of meant to be a bit like, I can't remember what it's called, the Bullingdon Club. It's clearly a comment on that. And they were having a dinner in a private room in a pub. And at the end of the meal, the idea is that every year they go to a pub, they trash the pub, and they leave a blank check. And I think what's quite interesting is I think it's such an impressively written play, because maybe not for everyone, but for me watching, you really like them. Like the first two acts maybe of the play, they seem charming. They seem so charming, these boys, and so fun. And they're very, you know, they're very sort of classic Oxford posh boys, but they're sort of a bit buffoonish and lovable and maybe even a little bit sexy. And, you know, you sort of, I remember watching going, oh, that'd be a fun dinner party to be at. And then at the end, they end up trashing this room and ultimately, like, really horrendously beating up the landlord. And it is absolutely one of the most memorable, for me, responses I've had to something in the theatre, because they'd so brought me into loving them.
Yeah.
And then when they showed their true colours, a little like Salome, you as an audience member feel a bit complicit in being like, oh, God, I wanted to be there. Half an hour ago, I wanted to be at that dinner. And now those are the people I've aligned myself with. So I guess maybe in Salome it's a similar thing. Do you think the audience also love her up until that moment?
I think, honestly, it depends on who's playing Salome and how. You know, it was created as a Sarah Bernhardt role.
Yes, I heard about this.
Although I don't think she ever played it.
No, she sort of prepped it and then never played it. But she, interestingly, was something like 47?
And one-legged. Probably.
Was she?
I think so. I know the reviews were terrible, which fascinates me. At the time, you know...
And are these like French reviews or English reviews?
English reviews, American reviews. Wherever it was reviewed, it was
panned.
Reviled initially.
But and that wasn't, it's worth saying to the listener, that's not because people knew Wilde for, like we do now, The Imports Being Earnest, because that hadn't been done yet.
Yeah.
I think Salome was done before even any of the ones that we think of as being like Wildean comedies. So it's not that people were like, oh, I can't imagine him doing that.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
It's just, it was too, I think for want of a better word, too raw.
Mm.
And it still feels raw. And it's that rawness.
Yeah.
It's the determination, the awfulness of all the people.
Yeah. Not a single redeeming character.
Nobody.
Is that a problem though? Because I think... And maybe it's not. And maybe it's not within a one-act thing, within a contained amount of time. Because I think that's one of the things that, with my producing hat on, when I'm reading plays to possibly produce, or the plays that I maybe haven't enjoyed watching in the past, sometimes if there's no one you feel you can root for, it's quite hard to sort of find a way in. Do you think that's a problem in this? Or do you think you do root for someone, even if she's awful?
Kind of rooting for Jokanaan.
Oh, yes, okay.
But even he's pretty awful, and he's kind of mean to everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a, you know, I think the fact that it is not a...
You're not there for 90 minutes, 2 hours.
Exactly. Yeah. And also, there's a level on which, and now I say this, I feel like I should have done my research and found out if ever it actually was. It definitely ties into Grand Guignol.
What is that?
Okay, so Grand Guignol was the French theater of horrors. And they tended to either do original stories or to adapt things like Edgar Allan Poe. There was a lot of mutilation, a lot of murder, it was a very small theater,
yeah.
And the idea was that, you know, you needed to sign a thing before you went in saying that...
I'm okay with seeing anything.
More to the point that you had a strong heart, you weren't pregnant.
Wow.
The idea is very much to...
Yes.
To get people into that mood and into the headspace. And also, of course, because the Grand Guignol people understood one of the weird ways that bodies work, they would also have comedies. You get one-act plays, some of which were funny.
Yeah.
And some of which was scary. And the great thing about funny is it gets you hyperventilating.
And
it actually, you know, it opens everything up and you've laughed a bit.
Yes.
So then when you do the, you know, the tar and feather story or whatever, suddenly people actually are fainting on you because they just tipped over. What I was going to say is I don't know if Salome was ever done as Grand Guignol. I think the language is too florid and there's too much extraneous. You'd want to strip it down a bit. But at the end of the day, there's a Grand Guignol level to it as well. You're kind of enjoying it in the way that you enjoy a good horror movie, which allows nobody to be sympathetic.
You are
actually allowed. It's like a great episode of Inside Number 9. Sometimes you have characters you love, and sometimes you're just like, I hate you.
And I'm enjoying that.
And this is great.
A bit like early Succession.
Exactly.
But is there something interesting as well? Like, you said this thing of it wasn't allowed on the English stage because it was a biblical story. But as far as I could find out in my limited research, things did get on the stage a lot of the time, because even though they were biblical.
Well, you could. I believe there were lots of ways around the Lord Chamberlain's rules.
Right. And was it, but your raw thing, your sort of comment about it's so raw, is it actually, was it commonly believed that, like, this is an excuse? They're saying you're not allowed biblical people on stage, but really they don't want this play on stage.
I think the world did actually need to change enough.
Yeah. Before we could watch it.
Yeah, and I think there's a weird level on which, you know, the downfall and death of Oscar Wilde in its own way was the first pebble of the avalanche
actually
changed things.
Yeah.
You know, that 70-odd years later, you get the Wolfenden Report, and homosexuality gets decriminalized and all of this stuff. And you feel that actually, that thing started something.
It's a shame it's still not, I mean, to my shame, when you suggested it, I said this when we first met before we started recording, but I was so over the moon because I don't know it that well. I love Oscar Wilde and I find him so fascinating and I find his history so fascinating. And I know of Salome, like I say, but I hadn't even read it until you brought it up. So I think there is a shame that we still, it's like De Profundis. I have De Profundis on my bookshelf. I keep meaning to read it. I keep not getting around to it. But it's like there's these incredible things he's written that I think we do still as a society today put on the back burner, and then we repeat Lady Windermere's Fan a million times, and we repeat The Importance of Being Earnest a million times, and I don't know why we still can't quite look the rest of Oscar Wilde's stuff square in the eye. As a society, I don't think we do.
We don't. But I think part of that is because Wilde is slightly too big to fit. You know, you can... Where do the fairy tales go? The poetry, things like De Profundis, but things like the Ballad of Reading Gaol.
Mm.
Where does that fit? And Salomé doesn't fit.
And you mean, sorry, like to interrupt, but where does it fit in terms of like, what box can we put it in that people go, that's what I want to see?
What box can we put it in, but also what box can we put it in terms of understanding Oscar Wilde? Because it is so nice and straightforward to be able to go, Oscar Wilde wrote plays.
Yeah.
Oscar Wilde wrote witty, mannered plays that eviscerated Victorian values and life whilst at the same time subtly reinforcing them, writing from a gay perspective, but also from an Irish perspective, writing as an outsider, these insidery comments and this insider view, and this is what he did, and this is what he gave us.
And that's already quite complex.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so it's so much easier to say, and then there's Juvenilia. there's some other stuff, but you don't have to worry about that because that's not that.
So, okay, so on that, because you are a busy man, you have a busy day ahead.
Oh my
we
God.
Can't keep you much longer. We have spoken beautifully about Salomé. I would like to read it, but before we read it, can you tell me very quickly, Neil, because this was one of the reasons I wanted to chat to you so much, how have you found watching your stories, your many different stories, be adapted? And obviously, as a theatre or a play podcast, I'm most interested in Ocean at the End of the Lane. But actually, I think what's fascinating for you is you seem to have so embraced whatever medium comes along that feels right for something. You know, so you've had stuff made into TV, you've had stuff made into animated film, stage. Yeah, go on.
I just feel, I guess I've always felt, to use an analogy I've used a couple of times before, that I feel like a kid who got locked in a sweet shop accidentally at night, and it's my job to try and taste as many things as I can before they come and open the shop in the morning.
Awesome.
So, but also there's a level on which I've been lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a level on which I've never been too lucky. And
very
I think
good.
That's also important. The fact that I've had, that my hits have never been world-shattering hits. I love the fact that Coraline, the movie, is 15 years after it was released, more popular than it was 15 years ago.
Interesting, yeah.
It has more of a cultural presence than it did 15 years ago.
Yeah.
15 years ago, it was up against Up in the Oscars.
Oh, wow.
And the best animation movie.
Interesting.
And Up was also nominated as best movie, so we knew that Coraline wasn't allowed to get best animated because it wouldn't have made
sense. It wouldn't make sense. Yes,
so Up was obviously going to get best movie.
Yeah.
But I look at it now and I go, so Up got to be a giant cultural phenomenon and Coraline got to be our little movie, but 15 years later,
it's like a cult hit. You
people
know, people are in love with it.
Kind of remember Up. They like, and they're very fond of the first 10 minutes
I
of
was
Up.
About to say, we all remember the first 10 minutes.
They all remember the first 10 minutes of Up. And then there was a movie that followed.
Yes.
And Coraline.
The best 10-minute opener of any animated film.
Absolutely.
And then,
and then Coraline is Coraline.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that Ocean worked. I love that Ocean survived somehow. Survived lockdowns and madness, and I love that Ocean got to go around the UK and Ireland, and actually people, and it had the same phenomenon every week in every new location, which is for the first couple of days they were playing to sort of half empty houses, and then the reviews and the word would get out, and by the end you couldn't get a seat, and then they'd go somewhere else and do it again, and
do you have a favourite medium that you've seen your stuff turn into? Like, is there a medium that gives you the most, that has given you the most pleasure or surprised you the most?
I think live theatre.
Yeah.
I think live theatre giveth and live theatre taketh away. Live theatre. I years ago, National Theatre of Scotland adapted The Wolves in the Walls.
Right.
And I loved it. I thought it was wonderful. And I will never forget the second preview, which, as far as I was concerned, was as good as it ever got.
Nice.
And we had kids screaming in the front row. And it was just this thing, and it was amazing. And after that, the reaction to that was, that was a bit much. Okay, so how can we soften it and make it nicer and gentler and sweeter? We cannot have kids, you know, we're going to be cleaning up pools of wee in the theatre if we get it that scary. And I was like, no, that was
amazing.
It. That was amazing.
Yeah.
And going and seeing it since, you know, they made something wonderful and then it went away.
Yeah.
And it never, you know, it happened for a while and it stopped and nobody will ever see that thing again. And I loved Nick Powell's songs were so good. There was so much intelligence. There was so much, you know, fabulous performances and imagination. And that thing happened.
Yeah.
And then
and
it went
it's
away.
Gone.
So I think for me, live theatre...
The transience of it is magical to you.
The transience, the act of imagination.
Yes.
The fact that
we have to suspend our disbelief a bit.
Whether we want to or not, our disbelief is being suspended. And watching audiences during Ocean at the End of the Lane with tears spilling down their faces over their masks, because this was during high COVID, and they weren't crying at the sad bits. They were just crying at the bits where your heart is too full.
Ah, yes.
And looking at that and going, all of these people know that those people on the stage are actors. They all know that they're in the Duke of York Theatre right now. They all know that... This isn't happening.
Yeah. But their eyes are leaking.
Their eyes are leaking.
Yeah.
And yet they're being changed.
Yeah.
And that...
And it's a, what's the word? A flash, I was about to say a flash of lightning. Something in a saucepan. Okay, I'm getting all my phrases wrong. But it's like, it's that moment as well.
Yeah.
And then they're going to go out into the night and, you know, that particular show can't be done again or, you know...
A flash in a pan.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Like lightning, saucepan, something.
but it is. And, and that moment will never happen again.
Yeah.
And that thing that just happened will never happen again.
Mm. Anyway.
I have to read to you.
You have to read to me and you have to go. I'm so sorry. Right, so let's get Salome up.
Okay. So this is Salome holding the severed head of a Iokanaan. Ah. Thou wouldst not suffer me to kiss thy mouth, Iokanaan. Well, I will kiss it now. I will bite it with my teeth as one bites a ripe fruit. Yes, I will kiss thy mouth, Iokanaan. I said it. Did I not say it? I said it. I will kiss it now. But wherefore dost thou not look at me, Iokanaan? Thine eyes that were so terrible, so full of rage and scorn, are shut now. Wherefore are they shut? Open thine eyes. Lift up thine eyelids, Iokanaan. Wherefore dost thou not look at me? Art thou afraid of me, Iokanaan, that thou wilt not look at me? And thy tongue, that was like a red snake darting poison, it moves no more, it speaks no words, Iokanaan, that scarlet viper that spat its venom upon me. It is strange, is it not? How is it that the red viper stirs no longer? Thou wouldst have none of me, Ayakanan. Thou rejectest me. Thou didst speak evil words against me. Thou didst bear thyself towards me as to a harlot, as to a woman that is a wanton to me, Salome, daughter of Herodias, princess of Judea. Well, I still live, but thou art dead, and thy head belongs to me. I can do with it what I will. I can throw it to the dogs and to the birds of the air. That which the dogs leave, the birds of the air shall devour. Ah, Ayakanan, Ayakanan, thou wert the man that I loved, alone among men. All other men were hateful to me, but thou wert beautiful. Thy body was a column of ivory, set upon feet of silver. It was a garden full of doves and lilies of silver. It was a tower of silver decked with shields of ivory. There was nothing in the world so white as thy body. There was nothing in the world so black as thy hair. In the whole world, there was nothing so red as thy mouth. Thy voice was a censer that scattered strange perfumes. And when I looked on thee, I heard strange music. Ah, wherefore didst thou not look at me, Ayakanan? With the cloak of thine hands and with the cloak of thy blasphemies, thou didst hide thy face. Thou didst put upon thine eyes the covering of him who would see God. Well, thou hast seen thy God, Ayakanan, but me, thou didst never see me. If thou hadst seen me, thou hadst loved me. I saw thee, and I loved thee. Oh, how I loved thee. I love thee yet, Ayakanan. I love only thee. I am athirst for thy beauty, I am hungry for thy body, and neither wine nor apples can appease my desire. What shall I do now, Ayakanan? Neither the floods nor the great waters can quench my passion. I was a princess, and thou didst scorn me. I was a virgin, and thou didst take my virginity from me. I was chaste, and thou didst fill my veins with fire. Ah, wherefore didst thou not look at me? She kisses the head. Ah, I have kissed thy mouth, Ayakanan, I have kissed thy mouth. There was a bitter taste on thy lips. Was it the taste of blood? Nay, but perchance it was the taste of love. They say that love hath a bitter taste. But what matter? What matter? I have kissed thy mouth.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Liam.
Oh, thank you so much
for
inviting me.
That was a joy. Thank you.
Hear Me Out is a Lucy Eaton Productions podcast. Music composed by Tristan Kay and artwork by Rebecca Bright. Our heartfelt thanks to the estates and license holders that allow us to read our guests' speech choices. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please, please subscribe, rate, and review. You can follow us on social media at @PodHearMeOut. And enjoy visual clips of the interviews on our YouTube channel. Finally, if you would like to support Hear Me Out, go ahead and click the Patreon link at the bottom of the episode bios.